This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, Jodie Gore, a West Australian woman convicted of murdering her abusive partner, she speaks with us. She hopes her early release from prison will help people understand the full impact of domestic violence.
Domestic violence is serious, you know? It's like silent, but now it's out in the open. Hear more about it.
Do you hope that this might draw attention to cases like yours?
Yeah, I hope so.
But the WA Attorney General warns the case does not set a precedent. And the competition watchdogs urging banks to do more for low-income consumers and drought-affected farmers in another round of changes following the Banking Royal Commission. All ahead tonight on PM. But first, the Catholic Church has reached a landmark confidential settlement with a survivor of the notorious Ballarat-based paedophile priest Gerald Ridsdale. Lawyers say it's the first time in a civil case that the church has admitted liability. After a legal battle, the diocese finally admitted that it knew about Ridsdale's sexual abuse before he attacked their client, known only as JCB. So how significant is this? Dr. Judy Courton is a lawyer representing JCB and other victims of institutional child abuse. I just spoke to her.
It's the very first time a Catholic Church authority, in this case the Diocese of Ballarat, has admitted legal liability for the crimes, terrible crimes committed against our client by then Father Ridsdale. So it's highly significant in that sense. And it's this sort of accountability that survivors and victims need in order to get any form of justice. So it's very, very important.
Now, there's a timeline issue here, isn't there, about what the church knew about Ridsdale and when they knew it. Can you explain that?
So with our client, tragically for him, he was raped by Ridsdale in 1982. During the Royal Commission, the body representing the Catholic Church admitted to the Royal Commission that they had knowledge of Ridsdale being an offender way back in 1975. When we took this case and filed it in the court, the Diocese of Ballarat denied that they had knowledge about Ridsdale prior to 1982, when previously they had admitted it. It took us, or took our client and us, 12 to 15 months dragging this through a court before the Diocese of Ballarat changed its mind and decided to admit they had knowledge and thus admit liability.
And so what does this mean for others who were abused by Ridsdale? Is this a precedent?
Yes, this is a precedent in the sense that if somebody was abused by Ridsdale after 1975, we no longer have to prove in the courts that the diocese was negligent because it breached its duty of care. We already know now that the diocese, Bishop Mulkerns, had knowledge that Ridsdale was an offender, but they did not act, and they just moved him on wittingly to new dioceses, new parishes, to rape other children. I mean, simply appalling.
And so are other cases likely to come forward? Do you expect other settlements are possible?
Oh, absolutely. We've issued many cases against the Catholic Church in the Supreme Court in Victoria, and more cases, of course, are now coming forward. And our client has been incredibly brave. He has taken enormous emotional and psychological risk to take on the Catholic Church, and they have fought very hard. But our client has won, and we finally have proper accountability from the Catholic Church, and we weren't getting that in the past at all.
Judy Courton, thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Judy Courton is a lawyer who represented the abuse survivor JCB and many others. We have asked the Catholic Church for a response. Well, a woman convicted of murdering her abusive partner in 2015 has won early release in Western Australia, though the state's Attorney General has tried to douse expectations that it sets a precedent. Domestic violence advocates say women who suffer severe, life-threatening abuse should not be jailed if they kill their attacker in self-defence. And some are concerned that judges are not applying self-defence laws as they were intended. Bridget Fitzgerald has this report.
Jodie Gore touched down in Broome in Western Australia's northwest earlier today. Released from prison on Thursday morning, she told PM she's enjoying her freedom.
Oh, it feels so good, great, wonderful to be back home in country, you know, working on the land, you know, back in the Kimberleys. Yeah, I miss my country and my people and my family and friends there. Yeah.
And who are you with up there?
I'm with my my sister, brother and his children. Yeah.
And how did they receive you when you got back home?
Oh, they couldn't believe it. They thought they saw a ghost. And yeah, hugs and tears, and they saw me, they hugged me and tears came, and I was crying, yeah. Happiness, yeah.
Jodie Gore was sentenced to 12 years in prison for stabbing her former partner to death in Kununurra over a drunken argument in June 2015. During the trial, the court heard she was regularly physically and verbally assaulted. The WA government took the extremely rare step to intervene in the case and release Jodie Gore from prison. Attorney General John Quigley says the substantial history of domestic violence was a factor in her early release.
Now is the time for mercy.
But the state's Attorney General was very clear the case should not be regarded as a precedent. Jodie Gore hopes her plight will help people understand the impact of domestic violence.
Opened an eye up for domestic violence. Shed a light on that. You know, even though they have their alcohol and drug epidemic, but, you know, it's also domestic violence is serious, you know. It's like silent, but now it's out in the open.
Katie Crystal, the acting CEO for the Women's Council for Domestic and Family Violence Services, says that's wrong.
Women who are victims of horrendous domestic and family violence who then go on to kill their partner to basically save their own lives are not people that should be locked up.
She argues in any case where a woman kills a partner after sustained domestic violence needs scrutiny because there are many that have acted in self-defence.
We've had the self-defence law in for a number of years. It's not been used by judges in the way that I think it was designed to be used.
It's an area of law that University of Western Australia's Law School Associate Professor Stella Tarrant has examined closely.
If the law of self-defence is applied and someone is successfully raising self-defence, then they haven't committed an offence at all.
The academic believes jurisdictions around the country fail to adequately apply the law of self-defence because there's a lack of understanding of what it's like to live in a violent relationship.
We have a very deep assumption that unless we're being physically attacked at that moment, in that instance, at that second, then we're not in danger. The argument that we make is that there are forms of entrapment that are not about only being trapped against a wall with a knife at one's throat in that instant. We know that because many women don't survive those very serious forms of ongoing abuse. We know that they die.
The West Australian government says it will now amend its criminal code to better account for circumstances where domestic violence victims act in self-defence.
Bridget Fitzgerald reporting. You're listening to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Ahead, seven Australians with Chinese heritage share their views ahead of Tuesday's 70th anniversary of the People's Republic of China.
If we want to maintain our lifestyle in Australia, then we need to be careful about what China wants.
In terms of like economic development, I think it's actually quite remarkable.
Farmers are responding cautiously to the federal government's announcement of a boost to drought relief funding. Fresh off the plane from the United States, the Prime Minister outlined the plan on a farm in Dalby in Queensland, including an extra $100 million for drought-hit communities. Samantha Donovan prepared this report.
At a bull sale today at his place in Rockhampton, cattle breeder Darren Childs admits the drought is having a huge effect on his local community.
It's a funny situation at the moment. You know, prices for cattle through sale yards and that, and meatworks, etc., they're quite good. The problem that we've got is there's not very many cattle left. Everyone's trying to hang on to what they've got. But Look, you know, if we haven't seen a general break by, you know, January or February, what they're talking about, I think the crisis areas that we know of now, that area will be, you know, be by, that'll grow to a multiple of 10 or 15 of what we've got now.
Mr. Childs acknowledges that many more farmers are worse off than him. But despite today's announcement, he thinks the federal government should be doing more to help struggling farmers.
We must be really optimistic because we don't get a lot of assistance. Generally, we don't ask for it either. And I think that could be one of our problems.
After arriving back from the United States, the Prime Minister flew to Dalby in Queensland to announce the boost to drought relief funding.
We're going to loosen up, make more flexible the farm household allowance payments, more flexible on things like off-farm income, adjustment, things like this, and to ensure that it is more accessible, more readily available, and that will lead to some $56 million, we estimate, over the next few years, which will deliver more money in the pockets of farmers.
Mr Morrison is defending the government's drought relief funding.
Well, it's not just $100 million today. It's $7 billion that we've announced over the last year.
The National Farmers Federation says the Prime Minister's announcement is good news in tough times, but it points out the fact farmers and their communities still need to ask for help shows the nation has failed to find an effective and enduring approach to preparing for and managing drought. The New South Wales Farmers Association is calling for more help. Chris Groves is its vice president.
Any help is always welcome. But the thing we must remember is that this is ongoing. For our farming families, for the farming community, the drought is going to go on for a long time because rain will solve a lot of problems. But when it rains, we need to even be now thinking about recovery. How are we going to get back to business as usual once it does rain? Because there are many farmers who have spent hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars maintaining core breeding stock and sowing a crop this year, which is going to yield nothing. So that money is now gone. And when the drought breaks, or next year, we've got to turn around and start again.
Your organisation is saying that government has fallen behind in its assistance. Why do you say that?
We were a little bit concerned that some of the assistance we were getting wasn't filtering through to the farming community. But it's about having a continuous dialogue with the government. As an organisation, we have to keep talking to government and telling them what we need as a farming community. Both levels of government, they're in a listening mood. And I think, as today shows us, they're in a delivery mood as well. But that assistance, it's going to have to keep coming.
Chris Groves from the New South Wales Farmers Association, Samantha Donovan with that report. Well, the Prime Minister may have left New York behind, but he's still facing criticism about his claim that Australia's doing enough on climate change and that China should do more. So we thought we'd take a look at what is happening in China on the emissions front. Aileen Yang is an expert on China's climate policies and emissions. She's with the environment team at Bloomberg Philanthropies in New York. We spoke earlier.
China's biggest problem is, of course, its over-reliance on coal. Over 60% of China's emission energy coming from coal. However, the good thing is that in the last few years, we did see that China's coal consumption has peaked. It's coming down a little bit. On the other side, I think that the renewable energy story in China has been truly remarkable. China is by far the world's biggest wind and solar market. The government increased its renewable energy target from 20% to 35% by 2020. So it's got the good and bad sides.
So when countries like Australia and the United States insist that China must do more, is that a fair call? Because it implies China's not doing enough about climate change and emissions reduction.
I think China is not doing enough. So does every other major emitters. I mean, the set truth is that, no big country right now is where they need to be in terms of emission reduction. So, again, take the example of coal. The Secretary General at this summit has been calling for no new coal after 2020. Mike Bloomberg pledged in his role as the special envoy to the Secretary General to help achieve this goal. But if you look at which countries are still proposing coal, China still got a lot. Australia is also still proposing a few. But really, if we want to take climate change seriously, no country should be building any new coal.
So what does China's policy framework around emissions reduction look like? Apart from trying to bring down coal, what are the other elements? Is there a price on carbon, for example?
Well, China does have a carbon trading scheme. Right now, it's covering a few sectors. It's not yet the whole economy. However, I think that that effort has been quite important in driving some of the transparency and emission monitoring mechanism. At the same time, China has put in place very ambitious plan for electric vehicle. There's also building codes and reforestation efforts. I think it's fair to say that China is making a lot of efforts. I think it's also very important to look at what's driving the Chinese action. The real driver is really local air pollution. I mean, that's also an area that Bloomberg Philanthropy has been working with many Chinese cities. And I think that as long as that imperative is strong, China will continue to take actions. However, whether that takes us all the way to what the climate is requiring, that is, you know, China is not there. But I think that hopefully all of these efforts would also help the country build up the kind of industry and let them see the how this is bringing the kind of economic competitiveness.
President Xi Jinping is often referred to as the most powerful Chinese leader since Chairman Mao. Do you think that he does not grasp the importance of the climate challenge per se? Because given his enormous power, he could drive real change, couldn't he?
He definitely can. If you look at the rhetoric of the current government, it has really a very strong focus on environmental protection. He has these famous lines that you can have a gold mountain, silver mountain, but nothing is as good as a green mountain, which is very widely quoted in the Chinese political system. He has demonstrated leadership in this topic, but it's very much also just driven by the fact that he understands that China has a rising middle class.
China climate expert from Bloomberg Philanthropies, Aileen Yang. Amid sensational claims of a cover-up by the White House, Donald Trump has been lashing out at a whistleblower whose memo in the exploding Ukraine affair was published overnight. The president has even darkly alluded to past practices of lynching spies and traitors as Democrats push forward with an impeachment inquiry over claims the president tried to induce a foreign leader to get dirt on his main political rival. Ruby Jones has been watching events unfold.
It's 9 pages long and it's sent Washington into a frenzy. Overnight, the whistleblower's complaint into Donald Trump's phone call to the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, was released by the House Intelligence Committee. It alleges President Trump sought to pressure the Ukrainian leader to initiate or continue an investigation into the activities of former Vice President Joseph Biden. It also claims White House lawyers were briefed on the call and directed officials to lock down all records of the conversation. Democratic Speaker of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, who initiated the impeachment inquiry into Trump earlier this week, is calling that a cover-up.
There is actions that are cover-up. Yeah, when you have a system of electronic storage for information that is specifically for national security purposes, and you have something that is self-serving to the president politically and decide it might not be, you might not want people to know, and you hide it someplace else, that's a cover-up.
Acting Director of National Intelligence Joseph McGuire was today grilled by Democrat Adam Schiff on his decision not to provide the whistleblower's complaint to Congress.
We went to the White House first to determine, to ask the question.
Okay, that's all I wanted to know is chronology. So you went to the White House first. So you went to the subject of the complaint for advice first about whether you should provide the complaint to Congress.
The identity of the whistleblower is still secret. But in this audio obtained by the LA Times, President Trump seems to suggest there should be consequences for their source.
You know what we used to do in the old days when we were smart, right? With spies and treasonous, right? We used to handle it a little differently than we do now.
Former Trump advisor and CIA analyst Fred Flights told The World Today he thinks the whistleblower's identity will likely be revealed and their career will be over.
I think there's a bigger question here, and that's a matter of trust. The CIA is trusted to basically serve as clerks in this vital capacity to write up these phone calls and to safeguard this information if they're serving in the NSC.
The majority of Republicans have rushed to Trump's defense, with Devin Nunes calling the whole thing a hoax cooked up by Trump's enemies.
It's unhinged
It's just unhinged, and it needs to stop. And, you know, as we get to the, you know, we look forward to this whole whistleblower coming in to testify. This is going to be really interesting as we start to get to the bottom of and peel back the onion. And I think what you're going to find again, it's going to be the same people behind the Russia hoax are behind the Ukrainian hoax.
Dr. David Smith from the United States Studies Center at the University of Sydney says both sides of politics have a lot to lose when it comes to the impeachment inquiry.
So what is the biggest risk here for Donald Trump? How is this playing for him at the moment?
For Trump, I think he really doesn't want this impeachment inquiry to happen. Trump doesn't want investigations into his conduct, which could potentially involve investigations into his businesses. All of his behaviour so far suggests that he's got quite a lot to hide in that respect. So this potentially brings dangers for him that actually go beyond his presidency.
And is the risk here for the Democrats that the American public just won't get behind any sort of impeachment inquiry and they will see it as an attack on the president and unfair?
Yes, I mean, certainly Trump supporters will see it as an attack on a democratically elected president, an attack on his legitimacy. The broader worry for Democrats is that the American public doesn't seem to like to see the government at war with itself in ways that completely bring the government to a halt. Admittedly, we don't really know exactly how this will play out. Bill Clinton was quite a divisive figure for his time, but nowhere near as polarizing as Trump is now. So even though most voters, for example, didn't support impeachment when it came to the Russia investigation, it's possible now that the proceedings have actually begun that a lot of Democratic voters will actually get behind the impeachment proceedings.
Democrats have suggested the inquiry proceedings could get underway by next month.
Ruby Jones with that report. Back home, and despite the horrors exposed by the Banking Royal Commission, consumer groups say some banking practices still disadvantage consumers. And now the consumer regulator wants the recently updated Banking Industry Code of Practice made even stronger. Oliver Gordon reports.
At the conclusion of the Royal Commission into Financial Services, the Australian Banking Association amended its Code of Practice. But today, the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission's Deputy Chair, Delia Rickard, doesn't think the amendments go far enough.
Look, the first thing I should say is we actually welcome the amendments that the ABA has put forward here. They go to addressing important Royal Commission recommendations and some additional factors. But in a number of instances, we felt they really needed to be strengthened in order to meet the real spirit of the Royal Commission's recommendations.
Have you ever overdrawn your account only to be charged a fee? One of the recommendations Ms. Rickard puts forward relates to you.
So what we're proposing is a condition that requires that there should be no fees and no interest on informal overdrafts, and if any is accidentally charged because the systems don't pick it up, that it's repaid to the consumer.
Earlier this year, ASIC, the corporate regulator, approved the Banking Code of Practice that the ACCC is now wanting to amend. But the ACCC say there is no major disagreements between the two regulators.
I don't think there's disagreement on that, and we certainly spoke to ASIC about what we were proposing and they were quite comfortable with it.
So what do banking codes of conduct actually do? Do they have the power to change banks' behaviour? Warren Staples is a senior lecturer from RMIT University.
That is often the real challenge of these kind of codes, that they do often lack teeth. I don't know that we've seen many cases where it's been used against the banks. So even if it does have some level of enforceability, it may not have been enforced.
Toothless or not, Mr. Staples says the proposed changes appear to be a step towards greater protection for consumers.
You know, they appear to have merit. They're looking at some of the areas that were highlighted by the Banking Royal Commission, but I think there is some room to be cynical.
It's a sentiment echoed by Choice Consumer Group campaigner Erin Turner.
The problems with our banking system are deep. They're the results of decades of focus from big institutions on profits over their customers. There's a lot of work to do here, and one Royal Commission can't fix it all.
The Australian Banking Association was unavailable for an interview, but provided a statement saying it will consider the ACCC's further conditions following discussions with its members.
Oliver Gordon with that report.
Well, it's a huge week ahead in China, where preparations are underway for the 70th anniversary of the People's Republic. Drones and pigeon racing have been banned around Tiananmen Square, where a huge military parade will echo the one that was held seven decades ago that marked the victory of the communists over the nationalists. So we asked seven Australians with Chinese heritage for their views on this anniversary. Liam Cochrane has the report.
It's a day mostly remembered for this. A brown-suited Mao Zedong declaring a new era in front of a Tiananmen Square packed with soldiers and officials. But as the party faithful cheered, there were other new beginnings.
My name is Guo Shengchen, and I happen to be born on October the 1st, 1949, when the People's Republic of China was founded the same day.
The name Guo Sheng means born with the nation. And in a remarkable twist, her husband was also born on the 1st of October, 1949.
My name is Qingping Chen. Qingping in Chinese term is a celebrated peace.
The couple have lived roughly half their years in China, half in Melbourne.
It means that from personal level, when you turn 70, you're definitely pretty clear about what your life was about and should be, you know, the future. I like to see China more open, to have greater democracy.
For the Chinese diaspora, this anniversary brings emotions as varied as the nation itself. Some praise the Communist Party for lifting hundreds of millions of people out of extreme poverty. 24-year-old Vincent Gigliani was born in Australia to Chinese and Italian parents.
In terms of economic development and what it's actually been able to achieve in just a short period of time, I think is actually quite remarkable.
Liu Rendi agrees.
This sort of change is not easy to do for that. For 1.4 billion corporations.
Mr. Liu will be heading to Canberra to celebrate China's National Day at an official function. But for others, this anniversary stirs their blood in a different way.
Maybe it is my DNA. I was born with the mission to demolish communism.
Jin Chin arrived in Australia in 1988 and is now the chairman of the advocacy group, the Federation for a Democratic China.
This special day means a shameful to me, because the Chinese communist regime is still alive.
The victory of the communists in 1949 left the nationalist Kuomintang licking their wounds in Taiwan. Edward Lin moved from Taiwan to Australia 20 years ago. He's wary of Beijing's reach, even into Queensland universities.
My friends told me when they went to Confucius Institute in UQ, they were told not teach, not discuss, not talk about three T's in classroom: Taiwan, Tibet, and Tiananmen. I was thinking that's not right for a foreign government to tell our teachers what not to teach to our children.
Mr. Lin says Australia should safeguard its freedoms.
We can't see any signs that China is changing the dictatorship. If we want to maintain our lifestyle in Australia, then we need to be careful about what China wants.
But other Taiwanese Australians, such as Brisbane-based Regina Wong, are more comfortable with the way the Chinese Communist Party controls society.
In this moment, at this moment, China government, they as a good people to manage China.
The debate about China's role in the world has busted open most dramatically on the streets of Hong Kong. Fiona Hui has been in Australia for 15 years and says her brother was arrested for protesting in Hong Kong just last week.
I feel like it is actually a national day of mourning and sorrow, in fact. And I encourage people from all over the world on the 1st of October wear black shirts to fight against this tyranny, the Chinese Communist Party.
Some may protest, but millions will celebrate, with events ramping up until the official parade through Tiananmen Square next week. This is Liam Cochrane reporting for PM.
And thanks to Jason Fang for work on that story too. I'm Linda Mottram. That is PM for today. You can always find us at the ABC Listen app and wherever you get your podcasts. That's where you should subscribe and leave us a review too. AM and The World Today are also there, so subscribe to them and leave them a review as well. Talk to you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre.
And I'm Stephen Stockwell. And we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. Boris Johnson's Brexit plans were thrown into chaos this week after his suspension of Parliament was ruled unlawful.
Today's episode is the Brexit edition of Sliding Doors. We take you through the five most likely ways forward from this totally unprecedented point. That's The Signal. Find us on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.